All right. Well, good morning. First of all, thank you for coming. It's 8:30 in the morning, day two. It's impressive that you've showed up. You know, I had a hard time getting up today. 8:30 is not easy. But thank you for coming. The topic of the day is performance tuning Microsoft SQL Server in Windows Azure Virtual Machines. And my name is Madan Ormugam. I'm a lead program manager in Microsoft SQL Server, focusing on, you know, SQL Server running in on-premises, you know, SQL 14, as well as SQL Server running in infrastructure services. Part of my team also does SQL DB or SQL Azure or what it's called. So any questions that you have, you know, on any of these topics, you know, feel free to, you know, come ask me. How many of you know about Windows Infrastructure Services, Windows Azure Infrastructure Services? All right. How many of you have used it? Okay. Relatively few. And how many of you are SQL Server folks? Obviously, you're here. How many of you use SQL Server on a daily basis, weekly basis? All right, it's good. So how many of you know about this white paper? We published this early, you know, actually first week of June. This is a white paper that specifically focused on SQL Server performance in Windows Azure Virtual Machines. And the talk is essentially walking you through that. So I've provided a link. If you download the slides, you should be able to go just look at it. In fact, I'll show this really quickly. So this is the white paper. It's about 40 pages, some really good stuff. So, you know, but, you know, you don't have to do it now. This talk is essentially following what we captured in this white paper. So hopefully you'll get the essence of what this white paper is about. But I encourage you, you know, I mean, if there is one key takeaway from this session, it's to go, you know, download this white paper and read it. You know, there's some actionable stuff. We've put this white paper based on a lot of internal testing and as part of the development that we did with Windows Azure. So, you know, there's a lot of good stuff. Obviously open for feedback. You know, we'll continue revising it as we learn more. Performance tuning. I mean, I wanted to kind of frame this session with a couple of questions. You know, this is what we hear from customers, right? When SQL Server is running, whether it's on-premises, whether it's running in a virtual machine, or whether it's running in any other cloud providers, when you see performance impact on your application, end-to-end application, now the first question you ask, like, is it me? You know, is it the application? Did I do something wrong? Or is it the system? The system is not configured. That doesn't change here, right? The same two questions exist. You want to be able to answer each one of them. You know, when you see a performance slowdown, the first thing you want to know is, did I mess up in my application? Did I do something? You know, do I have to, you know, do some database maintenance, or, you know, am I using some T-SQL inappropriately? You know, all those things come into picture. Or is it a problem with the platform, right? Or, you know, the environment around SQL Server that is causing issues, you know, because I didn't configure caching or I didn't configure striping on my disk. I mean, you name it. So these are the two broad categories of problems that you would troubleshoot, right, when you think about performance. So we'll use the same frame throughout the session. On every section that I talk about, I'll talk about, am I tuning the application or am I tuning the platform? And I think you have to do both, right? It's not one or the other. And the way we've organized this this particular session, you know, we'll go through these topics. I'll give a very brief introduction. You all are SQL Server folks. I'm not going to belabor on, hey, you know, this is what performance is about and whatnot, but just to set context, you know, what we're talking about, what are the key performance indicators when you think about SQL Server workload, whether it's online transaction processing or data warehousing. Then we'll talk about the platform characteristics. And by platform, I'm talking about Windows Azure Infrastructure Services. Again, I'm not going into depth of what Windows Azure Infrastructure Services is. What I'm going to talk about is what it means for a SQL Server, right? The specific aspects of the platform that you care about from a SQL Server performance point of view. So we'll touch on that. You know, what are the key variables? And from there, we'll jump into best practices. You know, we'll actually talk about disk caching. We'll talk about configuration. And then I'll also do a couple of demos where I'll actually go through a typical troubleshooting workflow. You know, I'm running my app. I migrated it from on-premises. I'm seeing a slowdown. You know, I'm looking at some tools, you know, SQL Server DMVs, you know, performance counters. Then I figure out what the problem is, I fix it. So I'll kind of go through a couple of these workflows so you would actually get a sense of what the white paper is telling you, right? The white paper documents, as I said, in gory detail, right? It even has a specific set of performance counters that you have to track and whatnot specifically for Windows Azure Virtual Machine. All right, so just to start with some context. So when we think about SQL Server performance, right, there are few KPIs or key performance indicators that you care about, you know. One is the throughput from a database point of view, and another is, you know, the response time or latency, right? People use different names for this, but essentially it comes down to two. You know, what's my application throughput? In SQL Server lingo, you know, we've used as, you know, batch requests per second. You know, we have performance counters or just transactions per second. People use different ways to express this as well. Price performance. If you care about power, you know, it's a watt performance. But at the end of the day, it's about how much work SQL Server is doing, right? The other dimension, the latency or the response time, is how long does it take for each query? Does it take 3 minutes? Does it take, you know, 10 seconds? Is it predictable? So those are the two, you know, KPIs. And if you think about the dimensions, obviously, you know, SQL Server is a database product. It cares about data integrity. You know, it's basically a mix of reads and writes, right, in terms of input-output operations. And the dimensions that you care about in each of these throughputs, and this is how you define the class of database workload is, you know, if you characterize an online transaction processing, it's typically more reads than writes, right? Anywhere between 60 to 90% reads, and you know, the rest being writes, and it tends to be random. So think of it as a banking application or a stock broker application. That's a classic OLTP example. Data warehouse on the other side, you know, it's decision support style queries. You know, you have a huge amount of data that you have to kind of go through back and forth, scan. A lot of the analytics, like especially if you're troubleshooting SQL performance itself, that's a good example of a data warehouse. You're looking for top 10 most expensive queries, or, you know, doing some analysis on wait stats. All of them are examples of data warehousing where you're actually, you know, pouring through a huge volume of data to kind of get some insights, right? And then I called out log. Log is a flavor of a workload on its own, because primarily the way it does input and output, it's sequential, right? So it's worth calling that out as a separate workload, especially when you think about performance, because any one of these dimensions can tell you whether your workload can run in a Windows Azure environment, right? So that's the reason we said we'll call that out. We also talk about the I/O size and the pattern. You know, OLTP tends to be short, right? 8K, you know, basically page size, input and output. It's random. Data warehouse tends to be bigger, you know, 64K. And then obviously log is highly sequential. You know, this is a write-ahead logging system, you know, as most, you know, classic database systems are, right? So again, if I remind you of the frame, when you think about, you know, debugging a SQL Server performance issue, you want to say, hey, you know, is it my application that is not tuned properly, or is it the platform, right? All right, so let's have a quick overview of Windows Azure, you know, infrastructure as a service. And I, like I said, you know, my goal is to not talk about Windows Azure infrastructure services in the session, but to just talk about the key concepts that is relevant from a SQL point of view, right? Or a SQL performance point of view, more properly. So Windows Azure, you all know about it. There is a talk that Mark Rasinovich is giving at 10 o'clock, 10:15 in Hall 7.2. I'll highly, highly encourage if you're interested in you know, this particular topic. You know, he's going to go into a full architectural overview of, you know, Windows Azure Virtual Machines and Windows Azure Virtual Network. And he'll talk about this in much more detail. But just for this session, so Windows Azure is a massively scaled out, you know, cloud platform. You know, we are in 8 regions across the world, you know, hundreds of clusters of, you know, essentially machines and servers, you know, running compute, renting compute and storage and network, right? So at the highest level, essentially you have data centers and multiple data centers in a single region, and we have multiple regions, right? If you break that down further, every data center has clusters. Clusters are essentially just racks of server machines, right? Typically 10 to 20 per cluster. And, you know, when we need to, you know, build out, you know, more capacity, we just install a new cluster. You know, that's kind of the model in which we kind of scale out. The reason I'm putting this out is, you know, especially when it comes to SQL Server running in Windows Azure, you're no longer running it under a box or your own data center where you can actually go and tell your IT admin, you know what, I want a SAN behind this database and this one, you know, you can virtualize it. You don't have that control anymore. All you get is this experience through the APIs, or the portal, or the PowerShell, where you say, give me a VM, here's the size. That's it, right? And there is a contract there. You know, you get a sense of, it's not an SLA yet, but it's a sense of, here's what a virtual machine can give you. This much IOPS, this much CPU, this much memory, you know, whether it's overcommitted or not. So that's the contract that you have to live with. And from a SQL point of view, that's very important, right? I mean, SQL Server applications tend to be much more fine-tuned than other applications. And on on-premises, because we have database administrators who had that control, they can fine-tune every level, you know, every detail of it. But in Windows Azure, you don't have that capacity, right? So that's very important to understand. You know, there are knobs that are exposed. I'll talk about that. But the extent to which you can control the infrastructure is limited. And Windows Azure Infrastructure Services, if you follow the you know, the history of Windows Azure itself, Windows Azure, you know, was originally introduced just with platform as a service, right? And really quickly, platform as a service is where you do get virtual machines, but you don't manage the virtual machines. And what this meant is typically you have to write code that is stateless. What that means is, you know, you're writing a .NET app or whatnot. It has to be replicated in multiple VMs. So if one VM goes down, Windows Azure can stand up that other VM, and your code can just run just like that. Now, most applications in the world, especially existing applications, are not written that way, right? Definitely SQL Server apps, right? No, it's a SQL Server by definition is a stateful application. It changes the state. It has to store something, and it has to retrieve something, right? Any you know, database application is that way. So that's why we did the infrastructure as a service. And the key thing that you want to, you know, take out from this slide is it's different from what we had before, which is the worker role, the platform as a service role. Here, you can just have a single VM, right? And it's completely persistent. To go a little bit into detail, I'll go into the little bit detail on what is under the hood of the virtual machine. Obviously, Mark Rusinovich will go into farther out detail than you know, what we would cover. The other aspect of Windows Azure Infrastructure Services is the networking angle, right? Again, this is different from on-premises, where you exactly knew what the topology is. You can tell, hey, you know, I want SQL Server to be clustered. The primary should be here. The secondary should be here. And I need a high bandwidth connection. I need it to be synchronous, asynchronous. All the details are something that you could control. In Windows Azure, what we've done is we've recognized that customers still need that control. But instead of you talking to a hardware administrator in Windows Azure, we've said, OK, we'll expose this as configurations. And so customers can choose, pick and choose how their placement should be. You know, where should your primary be, where should be a secondary be, and whatnot. So I'm just highlighting a couple of features that are, you know, showing up in Windows Azure Infrastructure Services, primarily on the networking side, which is port forwarding. You know, people, a lot of people do this, right? You know, you have a bunch of collection of VMs, each having its own IP addresses, but you really have a single external endpoint, right? And that's essentially the idea here with port forwarding. You will have one externally visible IP address, visible to the internet, and you have your SQL Server database running in a virtual machine, but you don't want it exposed on the internet, right? So you only redirect the port that you care about, maybe the TDS port, right? And then the load balance set is, again, a concept that we had on the platform as a service, but it's now introduced in infrastructure as a service. Think of it in simple terms as an F5 load balancer or a software load balancer you might have had, right? We've introduced that capability so you can quote unquote, rent this capability from Windows Azure. And you can say, hey, here is my set of virtual machines. Here are their IP addresses, and I want you to round robin. So think of a configuration where you have SQL Server that is database mirrored. You know, you have primary and a secondary, and you want that to, you know, round robin, maybe for read workload, right? So that's something that you should be able to do with this configuration without having to buy a hardware load balancer or cooking up your own, if you will. All right, so what is inside a virtual machine? My Windows Azure virtual machine, right? So when you open that up, you basically see, you know, here's what you would see. You will see a C drive. That's the OS disk. That's where, you know, the operating system is installed. And you also would see SQL Server installed. If you go and kick, you know, install a SQL Server image from the image gallery. You'll also see a D drive. And D drive is, by definition, a temporary drive, meaning that if the virtual machine were to be shut down, whatever you stored in the drive is not going to be recoverable, if you will, right? And then optionally, you can attach as many data disks as possible, right? So you can actually attach up to 16 data disks on the largest VM. I have those details. And the C colon and whatever data disks that you're attaching, all of them are persisted in Azure Blob Storage. And what that means is you're basically writing something, you have SQL installed, and you know, you put your database files and log files in one of the, you know, the data disks. Every write that you do to that particular database file is stored actually all the way in the blob storage. The reason I'm bringing this up is it's an important concept to think about. It essentially looks like a SAN, right? If you think about it on premises, the model of where, you know, all the storage is remote is essentially a SAN or a network attached storage type configuration. And that's what Windows Azure is implementing with this capability, right? Even though when you look inside the virtual machine, it looks like, oh, I have local disks, but they are not local, except for the D:. Everything else is essentially, you know, stored in your storage account, the Windows Azure storage account. It's important to grasp this detail when you think about disk performance, right? Obviously, SQL Server is sensitive to the I/O subsystem, and this is where a lot of the nuances or the differences comes from, if you will. To do a bit more detail on these disks, so we have the OS disk. This is a C:. It's a completely persistent drive, meaning anything you write, even if you shut down the virtual machine or if the actual machine itself crashes, you should be able to recover. It's a dynamic VHD disk, which is expandable up to 127 gigs. And some of the optimizations Windows Azure did is for faster boot. Obviously, this is where you will boot your virtual machine from, so they do a lot of prefetching, if you will, right? You have the data disks. I told you these are optional data disks. You should be able to attach it from portal or through PowerShell or REST API. And they are all persistent, just like the C drive. However, these data disks are optimized for database performance, right? So one of the key recommendations that we make is, you know, if you have a database that is greater than 10 gigs, just put your database files and the log files in a data disk as opposed to the C:, right? And you will see better performance. And each data disk can be up to a terabyte, and you can have up to 16 such drives in the largest VM. So, you know, quite a big space if you want to think about it that way. And I talked about the local disk. You know, this is by definition not persistent. This is not persisted all the way to the blob storage. And it's actually, you know, showing up a local disk in that actual host machine, which is why when that VM is shut down or if the machine happens to crash, you can't guarantee that data is going to exist because this VM is going to be rehosted in some other machine in some other place in Windows Azure, right? So our recommendation upfront is, you know, don't even put tempdb. Even though tempdb is temporary in nature, but there are certain configurations of tempdb that you want to, you know, persist. Like, for example, upon startup, you know, you need the SQL Server service account to be able to create the tempdb folder, right? We've seen cases where customers say, like, hey, tempdb, I don't really care about persistence, but upon the VM crash or a VM reboot, you know, the ACLs are not, you know, preserved. So our recommendation is just put it on a data disk. You get the same performance either way. In fact, you can get better performance because of the configuration options you have on the data disk. All right, so these are the different virtual machine sizes. You know, I actually put the link here as well. It's all available publicly in terms of documentation. So you have virtual machines all the way from extra small to, you know, high memory A6 and A7. As you can see, except for extra small, where the CPU is shared, every other virtual machine, the CPU is dedicated. And so is memory, so is network, right? So this is something that we are trying to mimic as much as possible the on-prem experience, right? So these are reserved resources for you. Nobody, you know, no other virtual machine is going to, you know, take advantage of it, if you will, right? A thing to pay attention here is the disk space for the allocated bandwidth. So this is important because the storage is remote, right? You know, think of it as like a cloud version of the SAN. All your, you know, input-output operations from a disk point of view is actually going through network. So your network reserve, the allocated bandwidth, is going to kind of impact how much I/O you can do out of each of these virtual machines. So something to pay attention. And the size, you know, we talked about, and the current recommendation or the current documentation on how much IOPS you can get out of each data drive is 500. You know, now this number can go in future, but at this point when we went generally available, we said, you know, 500 is what you should, you know, plan for. You could potentially get more, but as we roll out changes, we're going to make sure that, you know, it doesn't, the maximum you get is 500, right, if you will, so. All right, so let's go a bit more detail into what this subsystem looks like because, you know, as I said, for SQL Server, this is kind of the key aspect of performance, right? You know, this is going to have a huge impact on your database performance. So it's important that we understand what's going on underneath the covers, right? You know, if you think about a SAN example, you know, a SAN is a remote attached storage as well, but then they have optimized it for certain type of patterns. Now, think of it the same way. Windows Azure Storage is a remote storage. It's essentially showing up inside a VM as an NTFS volume, right? You know, you can attach as much drives as possible. The key thing that you want to understand, the difference between the SAN example on-prem and the cloud example with Windows Azure Storage is, here it's actually, by design, already reliable. Meaning, the blob storage is replicated thrice. So once you write a data there, you know, you're basically guaranteed 3/9 of availability. Even if the VM crashes, you know, you should be able to recover your data. So that's the big difference from SAN. You know, we have SAN solutions that provide that level of availability, but at a very different price point, right? So that's something that you want to think about. Now, this, what this does is this particular point makes you think about backup restore, right? You know, if backup restore is done just for, you know, reliability or availability, you may want to rethink that. You don't even have to do a backup restore because the data that you're writing is already replicated thrice. Now, you may still have to do backup restore for oops recovery. Oh, you know, I did something wrong. I need to be able to go back, right? So that need exists. But it, the fact that this is fundamentally already available and reliable is something that, you know, you should take advantage of. So like I said, triple redundancy. You can also, by option, turn on geo-replication. And geo-replication means basically if you're storing it in a particular region, say, you know, Amsterdam, for example, you know, it automatically gets replicated to Dublin, right? And if you choose that option. By default, I believe that option is on. You can obviously, you know, disable it as well. And what that means is if this particular region were to go down for disaster reasons or you have a business continuity, all your data is going to be saved there and you should be able to recover it after a certain point, if you will. The performance, so this is one of the key statements that you want to take away from this slide. When you think about performance on-premises and on Windows Azure or any other cloud provider for that matter, you are going to see more variability, right? And the reason for that is, you know, any storage subsystems in cloud, unless it is a dedicated machine, for example, in Rackspace, you can actually, you know, rent machines which is just yourself, right? Nobody else touches it. Unless it is that kind of a model, almost every other cloud provider essentially have a multi-tenant storage service, right? And what that means is you're essentially running your workload. It is safe, it's isolated, but there are other customers who are also running on the big, you know, cloud SAN, if you will, right? And by that nature, you're going to see variability, right? And the goal of any cloud platform, and obviously for Azure, is to make it as predictable as possible, but it's not going to be as constant as on-premises, where, you know, it's a machine that's running under your desk or under your data center, where nobody else is sharing that space, right? And, you know, the trade-off here is you're getting it at probably a fraction of cost of managing the infrastructure yourself, but, you know, you have to deal with that variability, right? I think that's about it in this. The other thing that I want to talk about is the disk caching. Right, so now this is a platform-specific configuration that you want to know about, specifically from a SQL Server point of view. Right, so if you open up the hood under the virtual machine, what's going on? So you have the virtual machine there. Let's see if I there is a way to. So you got the virtual machine here, right? So this is what you see. You have a C drive, you have a bunch of data drives, you have a temporary disk. Now what the Windows Azure platform does is it actually acts as an app hypervisor. It's basically just a Hyper-V machine, right? There is a cache here that essentially caches the traffic between that and the local disk. And like I said, this is meant for optimizing your temporary drive. Like this is where the operating system page file is put. So obviously, you know, you want it to make it as fast as possible. You also have another cache called a host cache, which actually sits between the persistent disks, right, C and D, and eventually to your blob store. The goal of this is to minimize the traffic between your system, the operating system disk or the data disks all the way to Azure Storage. The reason is Azure Storage is remote. You are going over the, you know, the network. It's not going over internet, but it's going over the network pipe between your machine and wherever the storage is running. So, you know, there is going to be latency involved. So obviously, if you can use caching to, you know, take advantage, if it's a read workload, for example, by all means, you know, you should use that. But if it's a write workload, you're not going to see any difference. In fact, you may see a negative impact, right? So the thing that you want to be careful about is, you know, the cache settings, depending on the size of the database, depending on your expectations in terms of IOPS and latency. And we'll talk about that. You know, we have some recommendations on, you know, what is the threshold of the size of the database where you should consider enabling caching or disabling caching. But the key point here is it's a two-tier cache mechanism. that essentially is optimized for a size of workloads and IOPS that fits into a certain size, right? So here are the default cache settings. So basically, there are three types of cache settings, right? So you have a read-only cache setting, which means that any read will be cached by that particular cache reserved for your virtual machine, and obviously you'll see the performance impact. Read-write is both reads and writes are cached. Now, from a SQL Server point of view, we've told customers, hey, don't even bother with write caching, right? Because SQL Server is a database product, and it does write-ahead logging. So if I can't commit my transaction and know that it's actually in the disk, then it has an impact on data integrity, right? Now, what Windows Azure has done based on SQL Server team's impact is every write, even if the write is cached, if SQL Server says flush the write, it'll actually write through. So they'll actually observe our protocol, the force unit access protocol, if you will. So there shouldn't be any concerns about data integrity running on Windows Azure. But you may choose to not use write caching. It's something that your application from application point of view you have to decide. And there is a setting where you can disable all caches. You can say, I don't want to do any caching. I want everything to go to the disk continuously, if you will, right? And here are the defaults. So the OS disk by default has read-write cache enabled. And obviously, this is done primarily because this is where your operating system runs. And they want to optimize for, the operating system pages being paged back in as fast as possible. Data disk, like I said, is what we are recommending for databases, right? And the default mode is none, right? For a certain size of database workloads, I think this is probably the right thing. But if you have a small workload and if it's a read-only workload, you can't turn on read caching, if you will. And temporary disk, because it is local, it doesn't have any cache settings enabled, if you will. All right, so let's jump into best practices. So we just talked about caching, right? So let's, here is kind of the, based on our internal testing and working with the set of customers during the preview period that, we have come to document. With OS disk, the read-write, what we've seen is it actually reduces the latency for I/O intensive workloads, but for smaller databases. So think of it as less than 10 gigabytes, right? You probably can fit almost the entire working set of your database in memory, right? So from that point of view, read-write caching is good. The default setting, you don't have to do anything. We recommend using data disks for any databases greater than 10 gigs. And what we've seen is in our tests, you can basically have to decide on what cache setting to use, depending on what you want. Is it a light workload, meaning the random IOs that you need is not too high, right? Not greater than 500 IOPS. In that case, you can use the default, right? But for heavy, sorry, in that case, you can enable the read cache. But if you have high input-output requirements, high IOPS requirements, we actually ask you to disable the caching, keep the default, which is none. Now, a lot of folks look at this and say, that doesn't make sense. I want high IOPS, which means I should have caching. How am I going to get more cache, more IOPS or more performance when I disable cache? The reason we are recommending that is because the size of the cache in Windows Azure, the data disk, is limited. So what we have seen is if you are doing a lot of random IOs, reads and writes, you tend to fill up that cache so quickly that actually it has a negative impact, right? So in our testing for databases that are greater than 10 gigs, we've seen that enabling caching is not actually having a positive impact. In some cases, it has a negative impact, which is why we are saying if you have high random IOPS requirement, you can just keep it as default. And this is you probably saw this slide. So there is a portal hook on how you can go and enable per data disk what the cache setting that you want. It's pretty easy. You can obviously do it in PowerShell or REST API if you so choose to. Now, there is also another question that we get asked. Oh, should I use a single data disk or should I use multiple data disks and stripe them? And if so, what types of striping? Is it OS striping or is it SQL striping? So we did a bunch of experiments and we also worked with a few customers who were experimenting this. Now, if your database is less than a terabyte, and the reason I'm saying it's less than a terabyte because that's the maximum size of a single data disk, right? We say like, hey, just stick to a single data disk. And some people say, no, I want actually more than what a single disk can perform. I want more. Now, that is the case on premises. You can basically do Windows striping or SQL striping over multiple on-prem disks, and you'll get more IOPS. But not so in Windows Azure. The reason is every disk essentially maps to a page blob in Windows Azure, and you have a collection of page blobs that are contained within a single storage account, a Windows Azure storage account. Now, the performance cap for a Windows Azure storage is at a storage account level, not at a blob level. So, which means there is no additional advantage for you to use multiple data disks unless you actually need more than 500 IOPS or unless your space, the disk space requirement is more than a terabyte, right? But if your disk space requirement is less than a terabyte and 500 IOPS is good enough for you, you know, this is probably better. If you're saying, hey, I need more than 500 IOPS and the size of the database is 30 gigs, 100 gigs, 200 gigs, less than a terabyte, then I think we would recommend you to use multiple, multiple drives. Here are some measurements based on our testing, right? So, like I said, the maximum IOPS, even though you can get more, we did the testing with the maximum guaranteed IOPS, which is 500. And you can see for random 8K, you're able to get like a bandwidth of 4 megabytes per second. And sequential I/O, which is kind of what we do for huge scans and backup restores. And then for sequential I/O of bigger payload, multiple disks. So I talked about this. So we recommend this if your database size is greater than a terabyte. Obviously, we need more space, so you want to stripe together. Or if you want higher IOPS than 500. Now, the thing that you want to think about is, okay, you have two options in terms of striping. I can just have a Windows disk manager, say, stripe them and make them look like a single logical drive, or I can basically use SQL Server file groups or files to be able to stripe. Our recommendation is to use SQL Server file groups, primarily because, this allows you more granular control from a SQL Server point of view. We didn't see a whole lot of difference in terms of performance, one versus the other. But we stuck to our recommendation of keeping, just instead of using Windows Server striping, we recommend using SQL Server striping just because, this is all controlled by SQL Server. In terms of running on Windows Server 2012, there is a feature called Storage Spaces. That's something that you can potentially use. We've experimented with that, and we see some advantages to using that as well. And these are the aggregated measurement samples, right? So what you see here, what we did is we ran a workload with 4 disks striped, with 8 disks striped, and 16 disks. And we wanted to see, where does it scale, right? Because obviously, in on-premises, when you do these things, it's because you have higher IOPS requirements or you have higher disk space requirement, right? So one thing that I would call out here is how you see that, the IOPS essentially kind of doubles, right? It's almost linear from that point of view. Not quite so with bandwidth. Right, and this is why I said it's kind of different from on-premises because this is remote storage. Everything is going through a network pipe, and ultimately that essentially becomes your limiting factor. Right, so in terms of IOPS, Windows Azure can actually serve a lot more IOPS than your single SATA disks or SAS disks that you can get your hands on-prem. But in terms of bandwidth, it's going to be realistically, you want to plan for something around this if you're going to use the maximum number of disks. And you'll see the same for sequential as well as the sequential I/O with 64K and 256K. And you'll see there the multiplication factor in terms of IOPS is not as much. In fact, after 8 disks, it's flat. If you're one of those data warehouse type applications, having 8 disks versus 16 disks is not going to make any difference for you, right? So something that you want to think about. Now let me show you a demo. I'll do a couple of things. One, I'll walk through this workflow where I have a classic OLTP app. It's a stockbroker application. It's a two-tier app. It's a front-end. There's a back-end with SQL Server. Now, what I've done is I have two machines, one machine with, one disk configuration and one machine with the SQL striping on 3 disks, right? And I'll show you. I'll, kick off the application. It takes about 2-3 minutes to warm up, and I'll show you, the performance impact of this. So, okay. All right, so this is the white paper. You can get done with that. By the way, this is the Windows Azure portal. And if you guys were following the news, so SQL Server 2014 CTP1 is right there. If you guys want to, if you haven't evaluated Windows Azure or SQL Server in Windows Azure, this is probably the best way to do it, right? you know, it's much faster to just go and provision a VM as opposed to downloading it and installing in a VM. All right, so what I have here, is basically two machines, I told you. So if you see the IP here, 10.199.220.29, this is the single disk configuration. I'm showing all the disks, but essentially I'm only using the Z colon. And this is the same workload, but I have basically striped across three disks. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to kick off the workload, jump to another demo that I'll talk about, and then come back and show you the difference in terms of performance, right? So let me kicking off a workload, and you'll see the performance counters starting to do this. And now, what I have here is basically another app. So basically, I have another app that I want to troubleshoot. Basically, I took it from on-premises, I put it on Azure, and I'm seeing a whole lot of contention. And this app, what I'm doing is I'm using a lot of TVP, you know, table-valued parameters. And what that does is it has a whole bunch of tempdb contention. You know, most of you know about this, right? This is the classic PFS page contention issue. So the app is pretty simple. You know, it basically installs a TVP table. And if you let me run this. And if you see here, you know, I'm saying run 16 threads and, you know, basically a 50 by 50 table, right? And if you see here, and this is my perfmon counter that I am monitoring. And I have a few counters, and I'm looking at the physical counter. But you want to pay attention to this, right? So this is kind of your equivalent of throughput. And I'm getting about, you know, 190 to 200. But what I'm noticing is a whole bunch of latch waits that are happening. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up SSMS, and I'm going to run this DMV. And if you see here, I'm seeing a whole lot of page latches, right? And if you scroll to look at the database ID, you'll see that these are basically, look this. So this is basically tempdb. You know, 2 is basically the tempdb, and 1.1 is the PFS page, right? So I have some contention going on. And because of that, you know, I basically am limited in terms of my throughput to, you know, about 198 or 190, right? Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to split my tempdb. So if you look at this, my current configuration of tempdb, it's not striped, right? So basically, I have a log and a data file. Now, what I want to do is I want to split this tempdb, you know, split it to, you know, I've got, you know, 3 drives, I've got 16 threads. So I said, okay, now let me actually split it by, you know, 16 files, right? So that's basically what the script is about. So let me run that. And then what you'll see, let me kick this off again. Once this is done, you will see that, and actually this is a good point to talk about another best practice. So when I'm doing tempdb splitting, underneath the cover, SQL Server is essentially creating new files and initializing the files. One of the things that we've seen with Windows Azure is when SQL Server initializes the files, one of the key things that it does is actually goes and writes zeros. So it actually clears and initializes the file. But that is unnecessary, actually, in Windows Azure, because Windows Azure, the subsystem itself, does it for you. Anytime you attach a new drive, it actually zeros it out. So there is a best practice that, you know, most folks have followed that in on-premises. So there is the, you know, you basically have to open up this administrator, you know, the local user and work groups policy. And you want to look at what group SQL Server is, right? And then what you want to do is go and turn on this setting for enabling instant file initialization. This particular setting is called Perform Volume Maintenance Tasks. And what this allows is it gives the Windows Server privilege. So SQL Server, the service account that you're running SQL Server, can actually disable instant file initialization, if you will. And just to kind of put things in perspective, without doing this particular step, this particular set of T SQL statements would have taken, you know, 3 minutes. And if you can see here, it actually finished in 40 seconds. So it is a considerable difference. So this is something that you really want to do. You know, if you're running SQL Server in any configuration in Windows Azure, you want to just, you know, enable this privilege. So things happen automatically. Okay, so now I have split my tempdb, right? So if I look here, let me go look and see how many files I have. And I've got about 16 here, right? Now I'm going to go run my workload again. Okay, my workload again. And let me bring up my perfmon. And you can see it's literally about 3 to 4 times higher you know, batches per second. Remember, we were getting somewhere around 180, right, batch requests per second. And now you can see the fact that I split this across, you know, the different database files, different data drives, is essentially giving me this much throughput. So that's the thing that you want to think about. In this case, I have actually split all the tempdb files in a single data disk, not even multiple data disks, and I'm able to, you know, push my SQL Server throughput, you know, almost 3 to 4 times, just like that, right? So something that, you know, you really want to take advantage of. Now let's go back to the one disk versus three disk. Yep.
Is it still on the same disk?
Yes.
Okay. So it's just in different files.
That's right. That's right. So that's a good question. Actually, it's a good point to kind of talk about. So what I've done is I've split tempdb into 16 different files, and I have a choice. I can say spread out the 16 different files across multiple data disks, or I can put it in a single data disk. Now how do I decide, right? The decision point is, do you want more than 500 IOPS for your tempdb, or do you want it's less than 500 IOPS? If it's less than 500 IOPS, you can split them up and keep it in a single data disk or the OS disk. But if you want more than 500 IOPS, then you want to spread it, right? So that's your decision point.
Are you still taking advantage of the storage service, like, because of the partition?
Yeah, so you mean, so let me... Yeah, so let me rephrase and make sure that I get your question. So you're asking, what is the advantage of, you know, storing all your files in you know, Windows Azure Storage? Well, two, right? Primarily, one, you get this triple redundancy for free, right? And two, Windows Azure Storage, it's one of its key value proposition is it's so cheap. It's a commoditized storage that's so cheap, and it's essentially boundless. You know, up to 16 terabytes, if you had to be able to think about from a cost point of view, on-premises is going to cost you a lot more in terms of managing it and keeping it available. And I think that's what you get for free, or, you know, get for a pretty minimal cost in Windows Azure, right? So those are the two aspects. The fact that it's scale out, and if you need to expand, it's completely transparent to you. It looks like a data, you know, an NTFS volume for you. And as you add more and more data, it just expands behind the scenes. And to answer your other question, when you go look under the hood, you won't be able to even tell that this is this drive. They actually sprinkle the data across thousands of nodes. That's right. So thousands and thousands of nodes that, you know, it gets composed into your virtual machine. You can always address it as D colon or E colon. But when you look under the hood, thousands of people using their drives is essentially sprinkled across thousands of VMs, I mean thousands of storage nodes. And that's where you're getting this unlimited IOPS, right? Because not everybody is going to be active all the time. Right, the elasticity is where we are able to give you this high IOPS at a rock bottom price, if you will, right? All right, so what you see here is, remember I showed you the one disk versus three disk, right? And I can stop here, right? So you see, you know, a tremendous, you know, almost like 10 times, right? It's basically an on-prem app that I moved to Azure. In one case, I basically just used a single drive. In another case, I basically did SQL Server file groups on three drives, right? Now this app on-prem was essentially performing around this range, but when, you know, I was only using a single drive, right? A single SAN volume, if you will, right? But when I moved off, you know, to Azure, I said, like, hey, you know, I'm seeing 10x impact. And I'm like wondering, hey, what's going on, you know? And then I said, hey, okay, let me understand the architecture, and then I split the file, and then I'm able to get near on-prem performance, right? So that's the best practice for you. You know, think about what's your IOPS requirement per disk or your application, and if it exceeds more than 500, you know, think about, you know, splitting it under multiple data disks. All right, so now let's go back to the slides. How are we doing on time? All right. All right. So we saw the 1 versus 3 data disk demo. So what other things can affect the SQL performance in a VM? Disk warm-up. So this is a characteristic where, you know, as I was explaining, under the hood, this is thousands and thousands of machine, you know, essentially serving a whole lot of drive traffic, right? You know, input-output traffic. So what happens is, as somebody was saying, you know, when you expand out, when you go from like 200 gigs to 500 gigs, you know, underneath the covers, we are actually allocating more space for you. And when we do that, there is a warm-up period. Think of it as, you know, something equivalent to a cache, right? So from a SQL Server point of view, you're going to see that, hey, you know, there's a ramp-up phase. You know, you're not going to get this 2,000 IOPS with 3 disks immediately. It's going to warm up because the system underneath is trying to kind of figure out, hey, you know, what is this I/O pattern? You know, what are their requirements? And so in order for it to figure out that optimization, it takes a little bit of time. Now, folks have asked me, what's the time? You know, what is the warm-up period? Is it 2 days, 3 days? It's typically anywhere between 5 to 15 minutes, right? But you know, there is no way to kind of put a number on it, primarily because it's all load trigger, right? If you take a data center or a cluster, depending on the traffic in the data in that particular cluster, you know, this warm-up period could be, you know, longer or shorter. But it's typically in the order of minutes. And if you are running SQL Server in that virtual machine continuously, after that one-time warm-up, you're not going to see this effect again, right? We talked about the single versus multiple stuff. I won't repeat that. I think the one thing that you want to definitely grasp here with the single versus multiple disk is when you enable geo-replication, if you're basically doing SQL striping on, you know, multiple data disks, there is something that you have to be really aware of. So if you enable geo-replication, by default, Windows Azure copies your data from one region to another region, right, asynchronously underneath the covers. But if you're using multiple disks, data disks, and you are actually doing striping on it, right, Windows striping or SQL striping, now the data that is written to each of the data disks, they are not going to be synchronized and written exactly in the same order in the geo region. Now, the impact of that is, say, a disaster strikes. Your entire region is gone, and you are using multiple data disks to write SQL Server data, right? On the other side, you won't be able to pick a time and say, synchronize all my data to this time. It's not possible today. This is something that, you know, we are working on. You know, in future, it will come. But today, there is no way to synchronize. It's not like you can take a time scale and say, OK, go back one day. Here is the exact time. In this geo region, I want all the data synchronized to that time. It's not possible with multiple disks. It is possible with a single data disk, but not with multiple data disks. So something you want to be aware of if you are interested in geo replication. The other aspect that you want to take away is today, the externally published target for a storage account in terms of IOPS is 20,000 IOPS. Now, for most SQL Server apps, certainly most old TP SQL Server apps, right, probably like 80-85% of, you know, SQL Server apps in the world, this is good enough, right? And that's where I think we believe that, you know, a lot of the SQL Server applications can migrate to Azure as long as you follow some of those best practices. I put a point around NTFS allocation unit size just because, you know, customers have asked us. Now, it doesn't really matter. You know, the default is 4K, we've changed it, we did some testing, but, you know, we didn't see any big impact. So our recommendation is just leave the default. You know, it's not even worth bothering about. But, you know, a lot of customers were asking us if, you know, there was an impact. Now, data compression. Now, SQL Server data compression, especially with page compression. Our recommendation is to use it. And the reason primarily is in Windows Azure, you pay for the storage, right? You pay for what you use in terms of storage. And when you use compression, you're using as limited storage as possible or as compressed storage as possible. So it has a direct impact on how much you pay at the expense of CPU. So this is what you see in these charts, right? The CPU time increases because you're doing compression. CPU's, you know, figuring out what to compress. But at the same time, your I/O footprint decreased. So what this means is you're only paying for this much when using compression. But you want to make sure that you have this headroom in terms of CPU. If your CPU is already pegged, you know, to 100% and you're enabling compression, it's not going to help, right? But most SQL Server applications, OLTP applications, tend to have a bunch of CPU headroom, right? Same thing in terms of throughput, right? So your throughput essentially, you know, increased with compression, right? Primarily because you're doing less I/O. And in a Windows Azure environment, typically, your I/O subsystem tends to be the limiting factor, right? You know, you can't push beyond 500 IOPS, for example, per data disk. And again, compression comes in handy because you're compressing the data, you're doing lesser I/O, so it has a positive effect in terms of throughput. Now, we talked about the instant file initialization. I kind of shows you, but look at this difference. I'm creating a 10 gig database, right? And the key point here is Windows Azure VM today, the default instant file initialization is turned on. So you have to explicitly go and turn this off, right? Like how I showed you. But you know that's something that we'll actually fix in the next few months. But for the time being, if you leave it as default, you can see that it actually takes 40 minutes, 40 to 50 minutes. That's incredibly long, right? Especially compared to on-prem where your storage is either direct attached or local SAN. So our recommendation is for any workload, any SQL Server workload, just disable the instant file initialization as I showed in the demo, and you'll immediately see an impact, right? This is one of those easy, low-hanging fruits that you want to do. And that's very specific to Windows Azure as well, right? Like a lot of our customers do this already, but in Windows Azure, there is a strong emphasis to do it right away. Okay, the other classic question that we constantly get is TempDB, right? And I talked about this. Hey, I don't care about TempDB. Every time I restart SQL Server, it basically throws away, why should I pay for it, right? Why should I have to, put it on a D drive and it actually writes to XStore, the Windows Azure storage and, essentially incurs me cost. Like I mentioned, I think the local drive or the D drive, there is no predictability that is guaranteed today, right? It basically is exposing a set of local drive space inside a virtual machine, and you get what you get, right? If there is some other VM that's hosted on the same machine and they get the space, you're going to see, a lack of predictability there. And that's number one reason why we suggest, even though TempDB is temporary, put it on a data disk. Because, you probably care more about predictability than, saving some cost, right? And storage cost is anyway so cheap that this doesn't make a big impact in terms of return of investment. The other reason why we suggest to put TempDB on data disk is because of configuration persistence. Like I mentioned, in order to create a TempDB folder on a different drive than C drive, the service account needs to be able to create that. And what happens is imagine a situation where the virtual machine is running fine and something happened to that physical machine, the virtual machine crashes, it gets rehosted on another virtual machine, and guess what? It's a different D colon, right? It's a different temporary drive. And your service account is not going to have the ACLs, the necessary privileges to go create it. So you start up SQL Server and you'll see an error, right? And that's not a nice experience and it's not predictable. And that's another reason why we suggested, not to bother with putting TempDB. Now folks have, put their own startup scripts to kind of get around, which you can do. But if you don't want to get into all that configuration business, just put it on a D colon. And like I showed in the demo, which is what I was supposed to do after this slide, if you put it on a D drive, and if you have an app like what I showed, where it was using so many temp tables, you can split them up. If it's a D drive, you can do that, right? The D drive is, not predictable. You're sharing that space with, other VMs on that machine. You don't have that option if you do that on the D drive. All right, so monitoring. So there are a few tools that you want to be aware of, right? Again, SQL Server is the same good old SQL Server, but the environment is different. And one of the key aspects of this environment is storage, right? So you're writing a bunch of IOs. Now you want to be able to know, I'm seeing some storage latency, what is going on? So Windows Azure Storage Analytic Metrics is a feature in the portal, right? And this is a screen capture of that. So there is a dashboard. If you go to the storage account, there's a dashboard called monitoring, and you can enable this right then and there, right? So you can say, I want minimal logging, and that means it'll capture a minimal set of logs on every write, and this is kind of the key information. It'll actually tell you per storage account how many blobs do you have, what is the total number of requests, what is the ingress, the incoming, outgoing, the average end-to-end latency, server latency, total number of failures, all the details that you care about. So you should be able to correlate from a SQL point of view. I did an I/O. You can go look at this log and say, how long did it take to actually write and come back to the VM? And whether it succeeded, right? So they have error codes that you can actually interpret and say, hey, this one was stalling for 15 seconds. And then you can basically correlate back to a SQL Server error log warning that says, I/O stalls, right? So this is important. On-premises, you had all the performance counters for your SAN or for your local disk, so you can actually go and correlate easily. Here, you have to depend on this tool, if you will. And like I said, enabling, it's not just in the portal. You can enable it through REST API. You can enable it through PowerShell. It's a very simple property that you have to set that up. Again, the deck has a link that you can actually click and find more information on. Now, the Windows Azure portal also have this performance dashboard. And essentially, all it is doing is just getting all the performance counters from your VM and showing it in a nice visual format, right? Again, it's basically under the Monitor tab. You can enable it under the Configure tab to say, here are the performance counters, go show it. It's just an easy way. If you're spending a lot of time provisioning VMs in the portal, right there, you can actually get those information. You can certainly, like in the demo that I showed, what I did was I actually remoted to these VMs. Over WMI, I was getting all the remote performance counters, right? So by no means are we saying you have to go to portal to get all this information. You can use the same existing tools that you have, but if you want to do this in portal, there's an option as well. The other platform monitoring tools, one of the big differences between on-premises and running on a cloud provider, certainly in Windows Azure, is the networking aspect, right? Now you're going over internet or you're going over a secure VPN, and maybe your part of your application is sitting on-prem, part of your application, maybe SQL Server database is running in a Azure VM. Now every network round trip is something that you want to pay attention to. And this might have an impact on your application. Somebody clicks, maybe Microsoft Dynamics or maybe an ISV packaged app that has a front end where you click something and it does 10 queries, right? Now suddenly these queries between the mid tier and the back tier, which is typically chatty, because they all were contained in a single machine. Now over the internet, you're like making so many round trips, right? So just use the classic tools, right? Rasinovich has a package called PS Ping, or PS Tools. That's a great tool. He'll actually show that today in his session. Or just the classic Traceroute, right? TraceRT. It gets shipped in every Windows Server box. It actually gives you the breakup in terms of how much time is spent between each hop. So you'll know if you're seeing an application slowdown, one of the first things that you can do is run TraceRT and say, is it the network that's causing this? If it is not, then essentially you can go to the next level of detail, right? SQL tools, like I said, the SQL tools work on-prem, work in Azure as well. There is no difference. SQL.io, we highly recommend, in terms of characterizing the I/O subsystem. Do your own testing, right? Your workload better than, any one of us. So even though the white paper has certain tests and certain results, we highly encourage you to use SQL.io. And if you look in the white paper, which I encourage you to go read, we actually have a set of SQL.io scripts with recommended parameters that you should be able to just copy, paste, and run it, right? So we made it as easy as possible to do your own testing. And obviously, perfmon and DMVs, I used it in my demo as well, right? You can use all those tools. It's nothing different than a simple virtual machine. What we thought was, based on our interactions with customers over the last year and a half for infrastructure services, we kind of captured the key performance counters that we saw us using over and over again, right? And if you see here, processor time figures out, right? Because this is something, especially when you use compression and whatnot, you want to be able to quickly tell, is it the processor issue? Is it running in a processor that's much slower than on-premises? So that's a common place where we see performance impact, right? Batch requests per second is your throughput indicator, right? How many transactions per second am I doing, right? How many, what is the translation from, say, a mid-tier, doing a query that translates to a SQL Server throughput? And then the web app KPIs are typically, these, right? If you're running a .NET app, and these are some of the classic ones that you can use. Now, you have all these tools, you're doing monitoring. How do you troubleshoot, right? The approach doesn't change, right? From a SQL Server point of view, here are some of the key areas that you would go after, right? If you're seeing an application slowdown, the first thing is say, hey, did the query plan change, right? Did something happen? Did it choose a bad plan? Did I do something to not pick the same plan that was performing, right? So that's what you start. The second thing you would think about then, if that's not an issue, is did something change in software and hardware? Did I upgrade my, from one cumulative update to the other, if you will, right? And the third thing that you will see, like I showed in the demo with TempDB, is do you have any locking or latching, right? Like the PFS page contention is a great issue for latching, right? Then you also look at concurrency. Did the number of users increase from 10 to 20 to 20 to 100 suddenly? That essentially causes some locking behavior. And then you also look at the system operations, right? checkpointing, is checkpointing impacting the performance of the user workload? If you're doing backup restore, is it impacting the, the user workload? So these are the classic steps that people would walk through. And it's no different in Windows Azure, right? And you know what you want to do is first define the KPIs. And I gave an example, right? And either it's batch request per second or response time or waves. You want to monitor these KPIs. You know, pick a subset that chooses for your workload. You look at the trends over a period of time. Use DMVs or you use perf mount counters to be able to monitor, say, where the issues, and then zero in and go address it, if you will. And we summarized all the top issues that we've seen in the year and a half when people are migrating to Windows Azure. And typically, it essentially ends up being one of these three, right? So this is something that we said, hey, we are seeing this over and over again. Why don't we package this, right? So if it's a CPU issue, right, where CPU is getting near 80%, you want to monitor this particular KPI, which is just a processor time, and then the SQL Server perf mount counter, which is the scheduler yielder weights. And if you see this happening, it is actually a CPU issue. Here are some of the actions that you can think about. Increase the instance size. Increase the VM size, obvious one. Now, if you're running already on the biggest VM, then you can start looking at what are my top 10 queries, that it's consuming all the resources, right? And if that doesn't help, move the database. If you have hundreds of databases in a single instance running on the biggest VM, consider moving that, right? So, this is a step-by-step way to kind of troubleshoot this. Another common area that we see in terms of SQL Server performance impact is, I/O issues, right? You being limited by how much I/O you can get out of the Windows Azure storage, right? Now, in the demo that I showed, I had a lot of these as well, right? So average disk reads per second, disk writes per second, SQL Server Buffer Manager page life expectancy. This is an important one because what this tells is how big is my buffer pool cache, and what's the activity in terms of writes happening to the subsystem, if you will, right? So this will give you an indication of if your buffer pool is being thrashed. I'm doing so much I/O, my cache is small, and I'm seeing a page life expectancy issue, right? So if you see, if this is the set of KPIs that you're tracking, it could be any one of these issues, right? So you start with looking at the page life expectancy counter. So this tells you whether there is a memory pressure, right? My cache is so small and has so much stuff happening that I'm not even taking advantage of the cache, right? By the time a second read comes, that read is already flushed, right? The other thing, if that's not an issue, then you can look at, is it a specific DB? It's a specific database in the instance, and it has a bottleneck. Other thing that I showed in the demo, this is the demo that I showed, it's like add more data disks, stripe them. Hopefully, that's something that will get over your current ceiling or cap. And then obviously, tune your queries in terms of making sure that, they are tuned appropriately for the Windows Azure subsystem. Definitely page compression, obviously that's the best practice. If you have enough headroom in terms of CPU, you're going to see a huge impact in terms of throughput. Memory resource pressure, obviously the VMs come in different sizes. Each VM has a reserved capacity in terms of memory. If you watch these counters, you should be able to go through these steps, right? Look at the max server memory setting for SQL Server, identify which SQL component is using, and appropriately tune this. Yep. So. So here, when we say instance size, we are referring to the VM sizes. Remember earlier I showed a table with different types of VM sizes, extra small, small, medium, large, extra large, A6, A7. So what we are saying is, I migrated my app from on-premises and I put it on a medium VM, and I'm seeing the CPU at 80%, right? So CPU is the bottleneck. So the recommendation is move to a bigger VM. Maybe if I'm medium, I go to large or extra large. Right, so you get like additional CPU cores, and then you can get over that problem. Right, so that's essentially what the recommendation is. Does that make sense? All right. Any other questions? All right. So we are near the end. So the key takeaways, from this session, if anything, the first thing I would suggest is evaluate SQL Server, CTP, you know, most of you heard about this in the keynote. It was available for download yesterday, and we introduced it in the Azure Gallery right away. Like I said, it takes few minutes, much faster than you downloading and installing it. Just, you know, take it for a test drive. There is a great dev test offer in place in Windows Azure. Most of you must have seen, I think, in all the foundational sessions, they had the brochures. SQL Server, I think they are giving it a 90% discount, right? So, you know, if you sign up for an MSDN-like subscription, you know, you have, I think, about 150 free compute hours. So it costs you nothing. Literally, you know, go try it out, right? And there is no better platform to try it out than on Windows Azure, right? And SQL 14 is brand new. You probably want to try out, you know, the features and see, you know, how it looks like. So start that. That's first key takeaway. The second thing is, you know, I talked a lot about performance. You know, take the key aspects of what I talked about, but go read it, right? I mean, we put a lot of effort. It was about a four-month activity between us and Windows Azure where we, you know, did a battery of tests, worked with customer workloads, different types of customer workloads, and kind of encoded our best practices there, which is what I kind of went through in the deck. But definitely, you know, take advantage of that. We will revise this as we go forward as well, right? You know, we'll keep updating as we learn more. Windows Azure platform, the IO subsystem, is evolving very fast, right? Unlike on the on-premises world where we ship every 3 years, here they ship every month, literally, and probably even, you know, in a weekly basis. So that means that improvements in performance, especially in storage and networking and compute, it happens at a much rapid pace. So that's something that, you know, we will keep an eye on, and we'll, you know, keep revising this white paper. Further reading, I have a lot of links, including the white paper. There is a whole lot of good documentation of SQL Server running in Windows Azure Infrastructure Services. There are some papers on Windows Azure Storage if you're interested, like this gentleman was asking, you know, what's the architecture behind? It's all publicly documented, you know, how we scale out. So you can actually understand that and put your SQL hat and say, what does it mean for SQL? We also have the classic SQL Server performance white papers. A lot of that applies, you know, with few nuances that we talked about. There is few sessions happening on Windows Azure Infrastructure Services, specifically from a SQL point of view, right? The first one is what I talked about. It's today at 10:15 a.m. at Hall 7.2. Don't miss it. You know, Mark is a great speaker, and he's going to talk about end-to-end from a Windows Azure point of view. And he also has some SQL demos in it, right, in more than what I showed. We have a session in the evening in N104 in the adjacent room where we talk about, you know, private cloud, but it also covers infrastructure as a service, both private and in Windows Azure. And specifically, I'll be talking about SQL Server 2014 enhancements we are making for infrastructure as a service that applies also in private cloud, right? So if you're available, do come, and I'll show a few other demos of SQL Server 2014 on infrastructure as a service. Today at 3:15, Rasinovich is again speaking about internals. It's a much deeper dive into Windows Azure, not just the infrastructure as a service, but he's basically opening the hood on how this whole massive infrastructure is implemented. Tomorrow at 10:15 a.m., we have the overview session. You know, you saw the best practices specifically in terms of performance in this talk. And tomorrow I'll be talking about all up. Deployment best practices, high availability disaster recovery best practices, licensing, I mean, the end-to-end from an application point of view. I won't go into as much detail on performance, just a slide or two, but you'll have an end-to-end overview, if you will. And last but not the least, tomorrow afternoon, we have a session that does a deep dive on SQL Server high availability and disaster recovery in IaaS. Just like how we did the deep dive on performance today, tomorrow you'll see a deep dive on high availability and disaster recovery. The topics we'll cover is how do you deploy SQL Server Always On, right? And if you want to deploy the SQL Server Always On premises and in Azure, how would you do that, right? And the best practices that we've learned from customers. So, any questions? This is it. Well, thank you. I'll be here. You know, if you guys have any more questions, I'll take it. Thanks, guys.